This means that Donald Trump will be the 45th president of the United States.
This is your life now. This is our election now. This is us. This is our country. It's real.
Hi, and welcome back to the 45th. Rabia here, and I'm here as always with my colleague Susan Simpson and a very special guest. But first, let me say hey to Susan. Hey, Susan.
Hey, Rabia.
How you doing?
I'm good, but why don't you skip me and get to the guest?
I'll skip you just for now and get to the guest because, oh my goodness, I am so excited. It took some doing to get this, and you don't understand like what it, the courage it took for me to reach out and even make this request. But anyway, I'm going to build a little suspense. Our guest this week is a critically acclaimed actor and comedian. He's a household name. He's got a very long list of TV and film appearances, but most people will know him probably by his Academy-nominated film from last year, The Big Sick, that he co-wrote with his wife, Emily Gordon. I'm talking about none other than the amazing, hilarious, brilliant Kumail Nanjiani. Kumail, welcome to the show.
Oh, thank you for having me.
We are so thrilled to have you. And, you know, I began following you online well before The Big Sick because I'm like, oh, my God, a Pakistani actor. My heart was full of Pakistani pride. I saw you in Silicon Valley as Dinesh, and I've seen you in so many other roles over the years. But I came for the comedy and I stayed for the politics because, a lot of your online stuff is about that. You seem very concerned about what's going on in the world today.
Yeah, I mean, you know, I started being on Twitter, you know, pretty much early on, and I decided that Twitter was just going to be where I was going to say whatever was on my mind and little stupid jokes and stuff. And it would be, you know, if I saw a movie I liked, I would talk about it, or played a video game I liked or talked about it. I sort of decided that I wasn't going to put too much like thought into it. It would just be sort of how it felt.
So that's like Kumail 2009. We're talking about 2010.
Yeah. And so I've just sort of been taking that same approach, which is just tweeting about what's on my mind. And it just so happens that in the last couple of years, it's been something more specific.
Yeah. Twitter, I would say, is also my social media dope of choice. But I have to ask you first, we share a lot in common, right? We're both Muslims who are pretty real about, you know, what it means to be a Muslim and what other brethren are like. We have some hard-hitting Pakistani parents who have no problem traumatizing us with the truth. So I had to ask you, I mean, you've had tremendous success and well-deserved. I love The Big Sick. It was such a great movie with this film. So I wanted to know, have your parents forgiven you for not becoming a doctor yet?
Oh, yeah. You know, they have. They wanted me to be a doctor. And
right.
Excuse me?
Of course they did. Of course they
did. Yeah. And I mean, you know, I'm from a family of doctors. My cousins are doctors. My uncles are doctors. The Nanjiani family is like a doctor family. So they then, when I said I couldn't do that, they were like, just very concerned for me. They just didn't know what I was going to do with my life. And then it was, I think, a surprise to them when I started doing comedy and acting and writing. And then I think it was a surprise to them and to me when sort of things started going better. But, you know, it took a while. Like the first time I remember the first time I did Letterman, I was like, okay, now they'll get off my back. And literally right after that, my dad was like, when are you going to med school?
Look, I was pre-med up until like the fourth year of undergrad. So I totally get it. But you came to the United States how long ago? How old were you when you came to the U.S.?
I was like 19 or 18.
So you came for college?
Yes.
Were you pre-med as well?
No. So me coming to America was sort of me shunning medical, like pre-med, because there's a school in Karachi called Aga Khan. Do you know of it?
Oh, God, yes. I had the brochures for that when I was like 13.
Of course, AKU. So that was where, you know, that's like the best med school in Pakistan. And so when I was doing my A-levels, you have to sort of take biology and chemistry to be eligible for that. And I dropped biology a couple weeks in just because I didn't like the teacher and the teacher didn't like me. And it was the first time I was like forced to ask myself, like, do I want to be a doctor this bad? And then, of course, I dropped it. And then 2 years later, when it was time to come to America, I was terrified. All my friends were going to AKU. And I was like, oh, my God, I've made a huge mistake. I should have been a doctor. That went away pretty quickly. I realized that, you know, 2 years of awkwardness is not a good enough reason to be a doctor, trying to avoid awkwardness.
So you came to America and found your freedom. But what did you get into comedy immediately when you, or like, is this something like a childhood kind of dream of yours? Or did you have comedians you looked up to? Where did this come from?
Not really. I mean, I always loved comedy, but not any more than anybody else did. What I really loved were like sci-fi and horror. That was what I really, really loved. And I was very, very shy. So honestly, it's very surprising to everyone that I became a comedian. It's very surprising to my parents. It's very surprising to my friends from, you know, back in Karachi, high school and stuff. So no, this was not ever the plan. It just sort of came at the right time. Like I started getting obsessed with stand-up right when I was getting worried about what I was going to do with my life. So, you know, my parents had sort of made me ambitious, but then what they'd made me ambitious about was not what I wanted to do. So I suddenly had this motivation and nowhere to direct it. And right at that time is when I sort of started watching stand-up comedy a lot. And so it just sort of filled that hole. It sort of gave that motivation and ambition that I had. It gave it a direction.
That's kind of amazing. I always assume, first of all, I think it takes a tremendous amount of courage to do stand-up comedy. So as somebody who's shy, that must have been very difficult. But also, I always thought people who get into stand-up have to be people who are just like, you know, they just kind of grew up seeking the spotlight and wanting the mic and making other people laugh. And like, this is kind of like their what came naturally to them always. So this is really interesting. But The Big Sick to me, you know, I have three kids. I let my older daughter watched it. She's in college. My 10-year-old hasn't watched it yet because—
Wait,
you know,
your daughter's in college?
I have an older— I'm like 100 years old, Gamal. I just photograph well. I have a 22, almost a 22-year-old, a 10-year-old, and then a 20-month-old baby. So I've been doing this for a long time. But my 10-year-old, who was 9 last year when the movie came out, she didn't watch it because I was like, I'm going to give her a little time before she realizes she can marry a white person. Not quite yet. I don't want to plant that seed yet.
Right. Right now.
Because the story is about you and Emily's relationship. And I remember watching it thinking, oh my God, I don't know about your parents, but so many Pakistani parents would be like, did you have to make the movie about that? How was that?
I mean, you know, we'd been writing the script for a while, and then I didn't tell my parents, and Emily didn't tell her parents until we got funding, because we were like, there's no point in having an awkward conversation for something that's pointless, that nobody's going to make this movie. So when we got funding is when I called my parents and I was like, hey, so we're making a movie. It's about that period when Emily was really sick, and I told you about Emily and sort of that whole time. And I told them exactly, you know, the ways in which it was similar, the ways in which it was different. So I really talked them through the whole thing. And to their credit, right from the beginning, they were like completely okay with it. I think they sort of understood that it's their story, but it's also my story. And so I do, you know, I don't know how to put it. They just sort of trusted me that the movie would be fair to them and fair to the events that happened. And then now they've seen it many, many times.
Well, I'm glad you were not honor killed. It turned out well for everybody. But I can only imagine their pride at seeing you host Saturday Night Live. First of all, incredible. You were so good. You were so funny. I mean, congratulations. That must have felt incredible.
Yeah. I mean, that was one of those things where it was a couple months out and I got a call. I was in New York having lunch with some friends. And then I took the phone call and they were like, hey, do you want to host SNL in 3 weeks or whenever it was? It was
surreal.
Yeah. I was like, let me think about it for a second, just because it was so big and so out of nowhere. And of course, you have to say yes, but then that comes right with a lot of fear, you know? And at that point, I sort of had not been doing stand-up for a while. I'd been off stand-up. So immediately I was like, all right, I got to write a monologue. Because, you know, when you're doing something like that, there's so much of it that you can't control. But I decided, like, the monologue would be my thing. That would be sort of what I do, would be the monologue. And so immediately just started working on trying to figure out the 7 or 8 minutes that would be there. And that's what I was most terrified about.
3 weeks to prepare, that's it?
Yeah, it might have been slightly longer. It felt too short. But it was one of those things where I couldn't sleep one night. And I just sort of pulled out my computer and wrote down a bunch of stuff. And then I rewrote it and worked on it a lot. But what I wrote that first time in the middle of the night was pretty much what the shape of the monologue was. Because to me, when I'm doing something like that, it's always the first draft is the hardest. And then once you've done that and you get the shape of it, when you understand what it's about, then the pressure is off. Then you can sort of work on the individual pieces. It's when you don't really have a vision for it. That's the scary part. And then hosting it was, honestly, it was a lot more fun than it was scary and nerve-wracking, which I was very surprised about. I thought the dominant emotion would be fear, but it really was excitement.
Look, every Pakistani who watched it was excited. We were like, it was such a big moment for all of us. And you made us all very proud. So thank you so much. Susan, have you ever gone in for a bra fitting?
Yeah, I did one time. Never again.
Never again? Yeah.
I think I like forgot the number right away. They told me one and I was like so traumatized. I'm like, I don't even know. Let's go home.
You just ran out of the store, your arms flapping in the air. I was in a retail shop last week. They're like, I was like, yeah, I'm going to get this. They're like, would you like to be fitted? I was like, nope, no thank you. Well, you know what? You can now get bras that are fit exactly for your shape and size without having to go through all that awkwardness with Third Love. Because Third Love makes their bras using millions of real women's measurements. They not only design it, you know, normally, like, you know, with a cup size and this, but also, like, your shape, the shape of your breast, because, surprise, we have different shapes.
There's like a lot of diversity there. Like there's a lot of ways things can be shaped, and this whole like one kind of bra thing ain't gonna cut it.
Right. Boob diversity is a beautiful thing.
Yeah.
And it can even happen in the same person on both different sides. But anyway, Third Love is the industry leader. They've got 70 sizes, including half cup sizes, which honestly I've never seen in any other bra company. And the reason you don't have to get fitted to do this because they have a fit finder quiz. You took the quiz, right?
Yeah.
A few minutes. Few simple questions and you will get your perfect fit. Over 10 million women have taken the quiz to date, and the comfort and quality of Third Love bras is unbeatable. They really, really are some of the most comfortable bras you'll own. They don't have tags on them. There's tagless labels, which I love. I hate having a little tag in my back. The straps don't slip. The fabrics are very smoothing, so your clothes look nice and not lumpy. They're lightweight. And the memory foam cups. See, I'm not a big fan of like foam cups in my bras. But these are really super thin, so they don't feel bulky. And
they get the job done.
They get the job done without letting everybody know they're getting the job done. And Third Love has a 100% fit guarantee. So, you know, if you don't love it, it doesn't fit perfectly, return, exchange for free. Look, Third Love takes its customer input seriously. They just recently launched the most requested style, which is cotton t-shirt bras and cotton underwear, which I'm very excited about. I'm going to be ordering it once the weather warms up. And right now we have a great offer for our listeners, Susan. Tell them what it is.
Third Love knows there's a perfect bra for everyone. So right now they're offering our listeners 15% off your first order. Go to thirdlove.com/45th now to find your perfect fitting bra and get 15% off your first order. That's thirdlove/45th for 15% off today.
One thing, Susan, you probably don't know about Gomel, and I was surprised to find out too, because this is way, way earlier than like my podcasting days, is that you were such an early adopter of all these technologies. You started off podcasting back in 2011.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. Are you talking about the video game podcast, The Indoor Kids?
The video game, and then there's the X-Files podcast. I mean, tell us about your podcasting career.
So basically, it was a huge mistake. I'll tell you why. This is what happened. Podcasts were getting big, and I was, you know, I'd been doing comedy, but I didn't really have, like, I was opening for people, but I didn't really have my own audience or anything. And I decided, I love talking to people about video games, and I was like, oh, I should just combine what I love doing with work, kind of, and then that'll make it easy. And same with the X-Files. I was like, this is what I love. I love watching the show. I love talking to people about the show. Let's combine these two things. Because I thought it would bring joy into my work, but what it does eventually is it brings work into your joy. Which,
oh, dear.
Yeah, it just sort of became that, like, as I was playing video games, I had to articulate why I was having a good time so I could talk about it later. And I sort of decided then, you know what, I'm just going to enjoy this. It's okay to have some parts of my life that are not part of my work. You know, for me, the struggle has been sort of balancing life and work, and the podcast actually had a negative effect on that. So that's why I kind of stopped doing them.
How long did you podcast?
So I would say if I started in 2011, we probably stopped doing indoor kids like 2015 or 16. So I did that one for five or 6 years. And then the X-Files one, I believe I did for like 2 years.
Okay, so you had a number of them running concurrently. That's a lot of work. I know. We've got two podcasts, so it's a lot of work.
Yeah. The hard thing is having to do all the research. For the X-Files, I started doing this thing, which was really fun in the beginning because I know that X-Files is one of the first shows to really have like a heavy internet audience, you know? So I found these old message boards from 93, 94, 95 when people were first talking about the X-Files online. I found those old message boards and I would read, you know, notes from them and what the conversation was like. And it was really interesting. But eventually, as the X-Files got more popular and the internet got more ubiquitous, the message board started getting very, very involved and huge, and having to go through that to find like interesting snippets became harder and harder. And that was a big part of the podcast. So it just was a lot of work.
Yeah, yeah. We completely understand that. I think with this show, it just takes some prep, but with our other show, Undisclosed, which is about wrongful conviction, I think every episode probably takes dozens and dozens of hours of work before you can get on. So we get that. But anyway, trailblazing and podcasting and so many other things. So how about we get into this past week's news? Are we going to start with today?
Well, did you guys get to see that, whatever that was?
I saw
something. Oh, the meeting.
It seemed kind of amazing.
Awkward and amazing. It was awkward.
Does that happen?
It was usually it's like the prelude. They come out there and like say a few nice words and tell the press to buzz off, and then they have a real meeting. And Trump kept insisting to stay out, and Pelosi is like, let's go inside now, and Trump wouldn't. So Trump got his ass handed to him on live TV.
I mean, it was really, really interesting to see. I watched some of it. Is this going to be a big political victory that he said that I'll build a wall and I won't blame you? Is that going to mean anything? I feel like things don't mean anything.
I was confused about who it would be a victory for, I'll be honest, because obviously he's talking to his base. That whole show was to show his base how tough he is. I think he's spiraling right now. He's terrified. And he's like, I got to get points for something. And so it's always about the stupid wall. And I thought he probably scored some points with his base.
But it's a win for Democrats because the pressure's now off them. Like the whole stupid game about like who's responsible for the shutdown if it happens. Well, now the Democrats can maneuver without worrying too much about who's responsible, because guess what? We know who it is.
So was that the entirety of their meeting, like right there on camera?
Yeah, with Pence sitting there, possibly half dead in the background.
Yeah, what's up with him?
I don't know. Something was up with him and he was like Xanaxed out or something. It was awkward all around.
He sees the end of the tunnel. He sees what's coming. He knows what's coming.
Do you think that's it? You think he sees the end of the thing? And so he's sort of trying to step back as gracefully and subtly as he can?
I don't think it's that simple, but I do think he realized that there is no political advantage to him to actually getting involved in that mess. I mean, he knew that, you know, Schumer and Pelosi were winning that, and there was nothing that his brand could be improved upon by wading in and joining Trump in the whatever that was.
I read some reports that like there's some chatter behind the scenes of GOP leadership now saying, you know what, it's time to abandon ship basically with this guy. So it could be everybody's gonna try, although I don't know. I mean, since the Friday filings, there's been a few folks who've come forward and said, yeah, so he did it, so what? But you don't think they're gonna
I think if they were going to do it, that time has passed. They couldn't if they wanted to, and they don't want to.
What's the point of Pence even being in that room if he's like sitting there half dead?
Pretty face.
Yeah, I guess. Pretty
trophy,
face.
My trophy VP.
My favorite Pence moment has been when he stood on the border of North Korea and South Korea and gave that stern look in the general geographical direction of Kim Jong-un. It's amazing.
Oh, that's what he was doing today. He was showing Nancy and Chuck the resolve on his face.
Not just any resolve, Susan.
The steely resolve. Is that what that was? Yeah. Is that like blue steel? Blue Magnum?
I think Trump might also feel kind of lonely, because we also know that Kelly is going to be out soon. In fact, I hear they say Kelly and him are already on the outs, which is another bit of news I wanted to talk about. But anything else you want to cover from today before we get into Kelly?
Well, yeah, let's get into the Nick Ayers and Kelly thing, because that's awkward, too. Everything's just awkward right now. That's the theme of the week.
So apparently, Kelly was going to be doing a press conference yesterday and announcing that he's going to be stepping down at the end of this year, but Trump trumped him. Just, I think he was giving some casual remarks Saturday on the lawn of the White House. And it's like, oh, by the way, John Kelly's going to be out. And that's that. And I think by that time, apparently reports are that Nick Ayers, who is it Ayers? I can't say his name. Who is chief of staff for Pence.
Yeah, he's poaching. Trump was poaching his Veep's top man. It didn't work.
But it's not happening. Nick's like, I'd rather quit everything.
Now they're both losing their chief of staff. And yeah.
So I have friends, obviously, you know, you guys, I'm sure, have all those text chains with different people about this, and different people have different perspectives. And some you go to when you want to feel better about it, and some you go to when you want to temper your optimism or whatever. So Nick Ayers or Ayers turning it down, some people saw as a sign that, you know, people don't want to jump on the sinking ship. Did you guys see it as that, or is it not that simple?
The indications I've seen is that it's the money issue, his disclosures. He doesn't want extra scrutiny for how the heck he's so rich as a political consultant at 36 or 38 or whatever he is. He didn't think he could survive the scrutiny.
He's made tens of millions of dollars as a political consultant, and I think he's 36 years old. But what scrutiny would he have that he hasn't had already? I mean, this is not an appointment that would have to like get confirmation or anything. It's just
but no one knew him. His name before now. The general public wasn't talking about him like they were like Kelly.
There's also the fact that nobody else seems to want the job, right?
Yeah.
So
whoa,
I think
whoa. Don't say nobody. There's one person, Kellyanne Conway.
Oh, okay. Well, I mean, what do you think, Camille? Any thoughts on who you think might actually take the gig?
I really don't know. I don't know. I mean, it's
Chris Christie that shameless? I keep wondering.
Yes, he is.
Well, Chris Christie has been saying some sort of negative things in the press too, right, about Trump. He said something a couple days ago or yesterday or something that made it seem like he just wasn't, he's always been so supportive, and this seemed a little less supportive.
I must have missed that. But what I didn't miss was what happened with Tillerson last week. Tillerson making, was he giving a talk or did he give an interview? I don't know. But he made remarks with the president where he was, you know, like, he's like, this guy wanted us to do things that were illegal. And I
he put it nicer than that.
Yeah. I mean, I think he was fairly respectful, but Trump tweeted back and he wasn't.
I know. He called him dumb as a rock.
Yes. Yeah. He said, he goes, this is the tweet in question. Mike Pompeo is doing a great job. I'm very proud of him. His predecessor, Rex Tillerson, didn't have the mental capacity needed. He was dumb as a rock, and I couldn't get rid of him fast enough. He was lazy as hell. Oh, my God.
It's always projection with this guy.
I love the way we've started talking about politics. It's like they're kids. Like the other day, you alluded to it, where I was like, Kelly and Trump aren't actually talking to each other anymore. It sounds like seventh graders.
Yeah.
Full on middle school almost every single day.
Because of him, because of one individual. I mean, Kelly was apparently, you know, they said Kelly was like the adult in the room. Everybody else is fairly professional.
There are no adults in the room.
No. And you know what? I remember when Kelly was coming in, everybody was like, oh, he's the adult in the room. Kelly's a monster. He's made comments about immigrants that have been very, very harmful. And these aren't like good people who got caught up in a bad situation. I think everything that John Kelly stands for has been pretty bad forever.
Oh, yeah. I think he's a total racist prick. I mean, he was the mastermind behind the family separation stuff. He said things like, well, you know, when he was questioned about what would happen to kids, he's like, somebody will take care of them. They'll end up in foster care. So like, he just did not give a fuck about these children, still doesn't. But, you know, the price of serving Trump, Tillerson paid it. I don't feel bad for Tillerson either, you know.
Does anyone on any political party anywhere feel bad for Tillerson? I'm going to guess no.
I don't think so. Okay. Fair enough. So there's not a whole lot of magazines that I read because, number one, it's a time thing. But also, you know, I mean, I usually want to read publications that just have beautiful literary style articles and in-depth stuff and also look beautiful. And that is why I love The New Yorker. You know The New Yorker. You read The New Yorker, right, Susan?
Yes. They cover so much so well.
Politics, news, international affairs, climate change, everything, art, poetry. Food.
Fiction.
Yes, fiction too.
Including the horrific cat person story, which still haunts my dreams.
Oh, wait a minute. I think I missed that one. What is that one?
Oh, God. Well, read it. It's good, but it'll haunt your dreams,
too. Is it called Cat Person?
Yep.
Some of my favorite long reads, and I love long reads because I love being immersed, like, you know, in an amazing essay. I love great essay writing, and that's one of the reasons I love New Yorker. So definitely I'm going to check out Cat Person, and then I'll blame you. Anyway.
Well, I love New York for a lot of reasons, but my favorite journalist there is Adam Davidson, who has been instrumental in writing about Trump's corruption and FCPA issues. So that alone is worth checking out.
Absolutely. Look, our listeners can get a great deal and get the best writing anywhere, everywhere if you order using our offer, which we'll tell you about in a bit. But, you know, you can get home delivery of the print edition every single week. You can, on the go, you get the New Yorker Today app, and the digital version is going to be available on your iPad, iPhone, Nook, or Kindle. And NewYorker.com publishes 15 to 20 news stories every single day that aren't available in the print magazine, which is pretty cool. So, you know, you can find them online. And they also have a complete online archive that features every single issue of the whole print magazine since, get this, 1925. Amazing.
Wow. I didn't realize it was that old.
Yeah, it's been around. It's iconic, dude. So, don't wait. Go to NewYorker.com/45th and get 50% off when you enter the code 45th. By the way, this also makes a great gift. In fact, you know, my dad's birthday is coming up. He is going to turn 78. He loves, like, Reader's Digest has been this thing. But you know what? I'm going to introduce him to the New Yorker. I think he's going to love it. I'm going to use this offer. Once again, go to NewYorker.com/45th and save 50% off when you enter the code 45th. With the special offer, you're going to get 12 issues for just $6, and you get the exclusive New Yorker tote bag. So subscribe to the New Yorker and read something that means something. Once again, that's 12 issues for $6 and a free tote bag. And I got my tote bag, by the way. It's a lovely canvas tote bag. When you go to NewYorker.com/45th and enter the code 45th. I was going to talk a little bit about some state politics, but you know what? I think because before Kamel jumps off, I want to get to Mueller time. And I want to start with this hilarious tweet, which Kamel, you tweeted this. You said, methodical, unflappable, fiercely intelligent, determined. I've assigned a whole personality to Robert Mueller, a person I truly know nothing about. I've never done that to this extent before. Good at karaoke, can do wheelies, once got a cat to literally mouth, my bad. Oh my God, it's so funny.
Yeah. I was making fun of, people really have assigned a personality to Robert Mueller. And
they have, yeah.
And depending on what side you're on, but the personalities are very, very defined. So like for the left, he's this, you know, guy who's got like this very strong moral core, and he's this really, determined individual. Whereas on the right, he's like this really corrupt guy or whatever. And neither side really knows him. I mean, I didn't really know anything about Robert Mueller before all this stuff happened, but I have so many friends who are like, don't worry, Mueller will make it okay. And I'm like, will he? What do we
know?
What do you know about him?
No human
desperate.
Can do what the job they want him to do. But also, I'm not sure I agree with your take on Mueller, because I can't say, like, if I had to describe Mueller in words, that, like, would be a fun guy at parties has ever crossed my mind.
No. He does have a great head of hair. I think that is
Oh, that's why Trump hates him. It all makes sense now. That's the conflict of interest he's talking about.
Yeah, that part is straight every damn day.
I kind of believe the cat stuff, but, and I don't know if you probably don't know this, Camille, but Susan has trained her cats to like fetch and do dog tricks. It's amazing. They also go walks on leashes. So if anybody can get a cat to say my bad, it's probably Susan Simpson.
I'll work on that. I think they can be out that. Next.
They can be out that.
That's amazing. But do you know what's interesting about the Mueller thing is also with the, I don't know how you say it, the QAnon, whatever that whole thing is.
Oh, right. QAnon.
QAnon.
QAnon. Those guys are or were on Mueller's side thinking that Mueller was actually, you know, investigating.
Yeah.
Well,
December 5th was supposed to be the day of this mighty takedown, like, right?
There's
like,
tons of days like that. I mean, I was actually wondering if, like, maybe QAnon really would go down now that Sessions is out and Mueller's clearly not on Trump's side. But of course they didn't.
Yeah. But it also speaks to, you know, sometimes when I'm thinking about this stuff and talking about Maria Butina or whoever's in the news currently, all the stuff sounds so conspiracy theory-ish, and obviously I think it's true and it feels true, but for the QAnon people, like, that stuff feels true, right? Obviously, but that's what's crazy to me, is that as true as this is to me, that is how true that is to them,
But their truth can, like, switch sides and theories and entire, like, universes in the time of, like, a QAnon posting.
That's right. Yeah, they have to constantly be jumping through hoops to sort of make things make sense that inherently don't. Whereas on our side, and I guess I'm saying sides, it's just connecting stuff that has pretty much made sense from the very beginning. Like, you know, like 2 years ago or a year and a half ago, you'd be like, if someone was like, what do you think happened? What we would guess happened is exactly what we see did happen. And there's just... Right. You know, there are like these leaks and news reports that slowly just confirm what every person who uses common sense has known from the beginning. Like, it's just always been the most obvious, least complicated explanation.
I mean, once you can go from, like, you know, sourced reporting to, like, court filings, I feel pretty confident in believing our narrative. I've, like, you know, I think it's pretty much been, you know, of course, they still have to prove some things in court. But let's talk about these filings on Friday. I think these things have flipped Trump's world upside down. He shook. He shook.
You couldn't tell from the tweets. I am not sure that he shook about all of it.
Are you kidding me?
Yeah, I'm not kidding you, because well, Cohen, he got his, you know, he's not sentenced yet, but he got the sentencing recommendations from both the SCO investigation, Mueller, and from SDNY. And Mueller went, like, you know, so Mueller is apparently playing good cop, and his job is really easy right now because SDNY is being a really bad, or, well, semi-baddish cop.
Can you spell out what SDNY is just for?
SDNY wants time. They want Cohen to go to prison.
No, what is SDNY? Can you just spell it out?
Southern District of New York. Mm-hmm. U.S. attorney. So for Mueller, and this is for Cohen's sentencing for lying to Congress about the Moscow Trump Tower that was in the works, Mueller didn't take a position. Essentially, he said, like, whatever sentence you want to impose, it's cool with us. Just impose it concurrently with the SDNY sentence, in which case it doesn't matter what he gets. Cohen could get between, like, 0 months and, like, 50 months probably, and you wouldn't know it because it sounds like he'll probably, well, 0 and 40 months, you wouldn't know it because he's probably going to get about 40 months from the other charges against him. What's interesting about the Mueller filings, not the sentencing for Cohen, but how it's clear that Cohen has been fully cooperating. Mueller had nothing but good things to say about Cohen. Information he's given is credible, consistent with other evidence, rada, rada, rada. That part might scare Trump. That's the part that Trump might be worried about. The rest of it, not so much.
But I thought there was also a point where, maybe I'm thinking of Manafort, but I thought Cohen also had lied too. And
oh, no, that's Manafort.
That's Manafort. Okay, so.
Speaking of Manafort, has it been clear that while he was apparently presenting himself as cooperating with the special investigation, that he was reporting back everything to Trump?
He's reporting some of it, or was reporting some of it back. They claim they had a defense agreement, which is bonkers. It's basically open obstruction at this point. Obstruction is just a thing they do. And because they tell everyone they're doing it, they've convinced the world it's not actually a crime. It is.
But they don't even tell people. We just find out. And then,
well, yeah, but then they own it.
Yeah.
And that's what Trump is doing here with the other part of the Cohen filing. So the thing that should have hurt Trump, and maybe it will, but I don't think Trump is really that concerned by. Or
the campaign and finance stuff?
Yeah. Then that's like key. Like in any other time in history, that would have been explosive beyond explosive. It would have been rocking the entire United States.
Well, Trump characterized it differently, I think, in a tweet today or yesterday. I can't remember. It's all one big blur.
Let's start with what the filing is. So we have from the U.S. Attorney's Office, this is from SDNY, not special counsel, from Trump's own DOJ. They said, quote, Cohen coordinated his actions with one or more members of the campaign, including through meetings and phone calls, about the fact, nature, and timing of the payments. In particular, and as Cohen himself has now admitted, with respect to both payments, he acted in coordination with and at the direction of individual one, which is, you know, Trump, obviously. That's a crime. The DOJ's position now is that the president is committing crimes.
Okay.
Wow, but, you know, there are certain things. I mean, if you think about, you know, it's all going to come down to the political angle of it, right? It's like, how long can the GOP go supporting him? And when it becomes, you know, worse for the party, they might jump off. But it's not going to be worse for the party because I don't think these people care about campaign finance laws.
And that's
what's
scary. It comes down to...
And they said it this morning.
Yeah.
But here's the thing. In 2020, if Trump loses, he can be... there's a lot of discussion and debate about whether a sitting president can be indicted, because the only thing that says he can't is the DOJ guidance, which I guess is not... I mean, it's not in the Constitution. It's not, law. But let's say he's not. I actually had a dream a couple days ago. I don't dream a lot, but I dreamt that somebody else won in 2020, but I have no idea who it was. So Trump was out. Let's hope this happens. But let's say if he does not win the election, then he can actually, I mean, within the statute of limitations for him to be prosecuted for this, right, Susan?
Yeah, but that's what's scary about it is that we now have a president who's going to be fighting to win the election, not just to win the election, but to stay out of prison.
Yeah, did you guys read that theory someone had that he may like step down a few days before the end of his presidency so he can get pardoned by Pence? Did you guys see that?
No.
I mean,
I don't know how that would work. You can't be pardoned for like crimes that you haven't been charged with yet, right?
Yeah, you can. You can. You've been pardoned.
Apparently you can. Yeah,
you can.
And really?
It all comes down to whether Pence would do it or not.
Why wouldn't he do it? I think Pence himself is probably implicated in some of this stuff, especially Russia stuff context.
I mean, if that happens, Pence has full power to do what he wants. Like, why would he ruin his possible future career by blatantly excusing Trump for something like that?
But that's pretty standard, right? I mean, that's what happened with Nixon.
Yeah, but that was different. And that was kind of complicated by the fact that you had the actually corrupt VP who was gone, supposedly not corrupt one had come in. For re-election, so he was sort of distanced from all that nonsense. Pence isn't really that distance from all that nonsense.
No.
Yeah. So the Cohen filings, number one, there's a campaign finance issue, but there's also Russia stuff, right? So I think a tweet that you did, Susan, that kind of enumerated the how many contacts between Russian...
Oh, there's tons. They right, really wanted that meeting. They really, really wanted that meeting. And it's actually not even in the filings we have from the recent Cohen stuff. It's not new meetings that are revealed. It's stuff we already knew about, but there was a line in Mueller's filing that I don't know what, I mean, again, we live in crazy town, crazy world, where this is not getting the massive play it would anywhere else. But he says, Mueller says in the filing, for example, in 2015, Cohen received contact info for a Russian national who could offer the campaign political synergy and synergy on a government level.
What does that mean?
Collusion. Like, what the hell else does it mean?
Synergy is collusion.
Yeah, collusion is not a crime. Collusion is like a word. And synergy is a word. And they mean the same thing.
That's amazing.
Is this what Trump tweeted about and said, clears the president?
Yes. We only want a political, no collusion, just synergy.
I have a question. You guys know this better than I do. Is the fact that this stuff wasn't redacted, I mean, all these details could have been easily redacted, right? The fact that they weren't redacted, does that tell us anything?
It tells us that, I mean, for whatever reason, Mueller's fine with that getting out. I mean, he does pick and choose very carefully what goes into the record and what's in the record stays unredacted. So yeah, it was a choice. Someone in that office made a choice to put the words political synergy in the filing, which these weren't Mueller's words. These were the words from the Russian contact who was offering political synergy.
I mean, it's interesting, I think, that Mueller is so comfortable having these huge sort of grenades just go out. You know, it feels pretty direct. Does that to you guys imply anything about how much longer this investigation is going to go on?
My guess is that they're being released because they're not huge grenades. I don't think that deal went anywhere. They lied about it. It was important, and it was the basis of the plea deal that Cohen agreed to. But that particular part of it, that guy that Ivanka connected up with Cohen from Russia, my guess is that because they're revealing it, that's a sign it didn't actually matter in the end. Uh-huh. And it could be they're pointing out the importance of it by saying, well, look, he's offering synergy, and you tried to say yes, or you were interested in saying yes. But the stuff that actually matters, stuff that's big, that stuff's still hidden, like the Manafort filing, which we got also last week. But
let's
also
talk about that.
What's there to talk about? It's just redacted.
Right. There's like four words left in there. Is it fair to say, though, he's probably going to spend the rest of his life in prison? He's pardoned.
In normal circumstances, normal times, yes. But we're not in that world anymore. He's playing like for broke. He's going to either die in prison or walk out with nothing, depending on how this all goes.
So if there was going to be a book written about me, it'd be called Why Are My Feet Always Cold? The Susan Simpson Story.
Oh, my God. But can I have a chapter in it? Because my feet are always cold, too.
It can be like a dual autobiography. But this is why I need and depend on Bubba Sucks.
I kid you not, I'm wearing them right now. I'm sitting in my PJs, recording today's podcast, and I'm wearing my Bomba socks.
I got two of them on, two pairs.
What?
So four all together. Yeah, they get cold.
I love Bomba socks. They are so comfortable. The most comfortable socks in the history of feet. Why are they comfortable, Susan? Why don't you let us know?
Because of science and magic.
Mm-hmm. Mostly science, though. 2 years of research. 2 years of R&D. They've got all kinds of improvements too. You know, you'd think some things like, you know, can't be improved. Everything can be improved, especially socks, because if you've ever had that, you know, uncomfortable toe ridge bump gone, not on a Bombas sock. They've got these little arch support bands around your feet that I love, and they're athletic socks. I wear them every single day when I go work out.
I like the fact that they don't fall down. That's like really the key thing for me. And they're warm, so.
You move around a lot, Susan. So yeah, you definitely need socks that that don't fall down.
They don't suck.
One of the things I love the most is that every time you buy a pair, Bombas donates a pair. Most people know that, you know, socks are the number one requested item in homeless shelters. It is cold now in many parts of the country. And these requests are often unfulfilled. But, you know, Bombas has donated over 9 million pairs of socks to date. It's kind of amazing. So look, you buy yourself a pair, somebody else is getting a pair. Somebody needy is getting a pair.
And guess what? 45th listeners get 20% off their first order today. Go to bombas.com/45th, that's bombas.com/45th, and you'll get 20% off your first order. bombas.com/45th, code 45th.
I was thinking about Kamel's question right now, like why would Mueller put out all these? I mean, I think part of it also is to put, you know, more pressure. I feel like this is the president who... He, like just what he did with this meeting this morning, he just shows all his hands. You know what I mean? The more frantic he gets, he keeps implicating himself. I don't know. It could also be strategic that, you know what, let's keep ratcheting up the heat, make him crazier and crazier, and then let's wait for January 1st for the House Dems to get in.
I don't think a scurrying rat has a strategy.
Oh, I mean on Mueller's behalf.
Oh, that part.
Yeah.
I mean, yes, if there's one attribute to Mueller, I feel that he definitely has proven he has, it's that he's strategic. That's about all I know about him.
Would say something?
Yeah, I was just going to say, it is interesting that with Trump, that there's no strategy has been so effective because it's so unpredictable. And then you can't sort of use the normal, you know, the normal standards in discussing what he does, right? All he is confidence. And it shows you how far you can get if you're a straight white man and super confident. You can literally become the president of the United States of America. He's not smart. It's just confidence. There's not one other positive thing about him.
He's not even that confident. You see him like when he gets in those meetings with like Pelosi and Schumer, he hunches up and like has, like, you can tell how uncomfortable and like scared he looks half the time, but he fakes it well for some people.
Maybe we're getting to the end of his confidence. Yeah.
Yeah. I think he's starting to unravel a bit. I mean, I don't know. To me, it seemed like his tweets were, I mean, like every morning it's just a whole series of the no collusion fake news tweets. But anyway, I know
you've been that way.
I don't know. Maybe I feel like it's getting ratcheted up a little more. But anyway, look, he is now seeing like some real stuff, right? Like with all these people being indicted and you know, making plea deals and going to prison. I mean, like shit's getting real, real now. But anyway, Kamel, I know you have to dip out in a little bit. First, before you left, I wanted to ask you, have you put your hat in the ring to host the Oscars yet?
No. And I will tell you, I don't think, again, first of all, I love the Oscars. I've been watching Oscars my whole entire life. I've just always loved them. And my opinion right now is that it shouldn't be a straight man hosting the Oscars this year, especially given everything that's happened. And so I just don't, I mean, that's just how I feel. That's just how I personally feel.
Well, I was going to start a petition, so I'll hold off on that for now. We'll do it in a year or so, but I want to talk a little bit about...
Hold out for a White House Correspondents' Dinner next year.
Oh, yes. So, Kamel, I know we're going to be seeing you soon in the film Stuber with Dave Bautista. When is that coming out?
That comes out in July. I think it's like July 12th is when it comes out. And it's really... I think it's really good. It's It's a movie that sort of, you know, it's like an action comedy, but it really is a movie about, I feel like we're in this era right now where we've sort of realized that masculinity, the way we've traditionally been portraying it, is very, very problematic and very toxic. And there is masculinity needs to really grapple with itself and redefine itself and figure out how someone can be masculine and not be toxic. And this is a movie that really actually is about that. It's about two very different kinds of guys having these conversations. What does it mean to be a man, and how can you be a man and still not be oppressive to yourself and to the people around you? So
in the era of Trump, it's a much needed film. It sounds fantastic.
I think so. It really is. I think so many of the world's problems come from men refusing their own emotions and not feeling what's happening inside. And so it all comes out as anger, as oppressive anger, which I think is why a lot of men are so threatened by certain things. So I hope people go see it, because it looks like a fun action comedy, but it's really about this other stuff.
Totally looking forward to it. I'll be in the theaters to see it opening weekend. Thank you again for joining us, folks. You can follow Kumail like I do on Twitter at Kumail N. And also check out, I've been actually just this past week binging on your stand-up stuff on YouTube. I want to check out some of your old podcasts if I can find them. And if you haven't seen
the video game podcast.
Oh, yeah. That's totally probably up your alley, Susan. But if you haven't seen The Big Sick, you have to see The Big Sick. All right. Thank you so much, Kumail.
Thank you for having me.
So today they had the announcement came out about the Times People Person of the Year.
Right.
Did you see what that was? Right.
I did. It was Time has four different covers. They've picked four people. And I think the theme is truth tellers, or the death of the truth. And so they've picked activists and journalists who are truth tellers in the face of power. And Jamal Khashoggi, who is murdered by the Saudi regime, is one of them. And when I saw the cover, it really did bring me to tears. It was pretty heartbreaking. I know there's been some news about like the transcript of the audio of his final moments was released, where he said, "I can't breathe" three times.
Oh,
Before he, I guess those were his last words. To this day, I mean, like today, Jared Kushner, when he was again asked about this, gave the nonsensical response that our intelligence agencies are still investigating this. And, you know, when we have more information, I mean, they've done their assessment. It's been recorded. You know,
they don't want the truth to matter. They want to be able to say that the truth is unknowable. And because they're in control of the truth, like discerning organ, the, you know, intelligence operations, they're kind of in control of all that. Of course, there's leaks that will come out in the face of the agencies not being listened to. But we know from the hearing that the CIA director gave, I guess, last week now, that it was clearly a premeditated murder, and that the evidence is overwhelming that the Crown Prince knew about it. So the facts aren't really in dispute. What's in dispute is whether they can get away with just ignoring the facts, which they probably will. I mean, I will say this is the one time that we've had some credible evidence of Republicans in the Senate and the House are being actually pissed about it. They aren't happy, and they're kind of doing stuff a little bit, which is, I guess, a welcome change. Mm-hmm. But they're not doing enough. They actually are pissed. We've reached a point where they will break with Trump on this issue.
Yeah, Lindsey Graham has had some harsh words, and I don't know who else, but after the briefing, or even before, I mean, he was kind of, you know, on it. But Rick Perry, though, our energy secretary, was in Saudi last weekend.
He was in the news? I missed. Oh, my God. I forgot about him.
I mean, not exactly news, but he went there and he met up with MBS. And, you know, they put out this press stuff saying, you know, had a great meeting, blah, 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 you know, just completely shameless. It's stunning.
Well, and the sad thing is that there's like open evidence of bribery, because after they... at the inauguration, the Saudis booked 500 hotel rooms at Trump's hotels, which is straight up bribery. And no one is blinking an eye.
I mean, like, do you think people were actually staying in the hotel? What was it for?
Whether they were or not, it was obviously an excuse to give Trump money. And they did it, and they pulled it off. And they're going to use this whole fiction of, oh, it's just my hotel, that foreign leaders can happen to funnel money to me through, and then I happen to make decisions that are wildly unpopular and bizarre, but favor those same foreign rulers. Yeah. I mean, it's straight up a bribe, and we're looking at it happen openly now in the United States.
Trump also has his eyes. The presidency does not matter to him. He does not give a flying fuck. In fact, recently he said something about, I can't remember, something related to the economy. Oh, yeah, about the deficit, that, you know, it was said to him that, you know, these deficit numbers are going to be like astronomical. He said, yeah, but I'm not going to be in the White House anymore, so I don't care, basically. And for him, I think, you know, this bribe is just like this bribe would be a small start. He's got his eyes. I think he's thinking after the presidency, after he's out of the White House, he's going to make so many more millions. Tens of hundreds of millions.
You can't make more out. If you're corrupt, you make more in power than you make out. He's making it now.
Yeah, probably. I mean, he said it, but he's obviously, these are all opportunities that he sees to enrich himself further once he's out of the presidency, right? He's setting up the ducks now to collect later.
I think he's collecting money right now. I mean, look at the filings for Cohen. We have the filings from New York and Mueller talking about like hundreds of millions that was going to come in from this Trump Tower in Moscow. That is far in excess of what those Trump Towers usually brought in. Far, far in excess. That sounds like it's politically related as well. And then, of course, you have the Crown Prince of America, our idiot Prince Kushner, with his like texting friendship with MBS, basically trying to help him get through this bad press time.
Like, that's really his problem.
They see murder as a PR problem.
Well, I'm hoping Kushner, whatever he goes down to. Well, it's been a busy past week, and Friday night was great for a lot of us. I'm hoping this Friday we see some more action from Mueller. And it was pretty awesome having Kumail Nanjiani. I mean, like, oh my God, he's a big deal.
That was pretty cool, Rabia. That was so good for you for being brave. Yes.
Oh my God, I got to do this more often. Who else should I reach out to randomly? Be more brave. It worked with, I totally forgot if he'd host the addendum. to replace John Cryer. Anyway, thanks so much for tuning in, guys, and we'll be back in 7 days.
I'll be on the plane to Australia, so.
I will be back in 7 days while you are flying across the world. I really should make some plans for next week. All right, sounds good.
Big thanks to all our listeners for tuning in to the 45th podcast week after week. And if you'd like to give us further support, you can do that by becoming a patron at patreon.com/45thpod. By doing so, you can become a supporter and patron for as little as $5 a month. And to do so, again, go to patreon.com/45thpod. A shout out and thank you to our sponsors. They make this program possible. And I urge our listeners to please check out our sponsors and use their products. And thank you to them for helping us produce week after week. Thank you to our audio producer, Hannah McCarthy, our executive producer, Meethal Thelhan, and you can find us on social media. We are on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram. Our handle is @45thpod. Our website is www.45thpod.com. Thanks again for tuning in. See you next week.